Thank you. Okay, well, I feel honoured to have been asked to give the closing talk at this workshop, but I have to say I also feel a complete charlatan. And in particular, I severely fear that I may be prosecuted under the Truth in Advertising Act, because I'm afraid that the nature of my talk doesn't really much correspond to my title, which was something like Overview and Outlook. In fact, when Jason first asked me if I would give the closing talk, I pointed out to him that I hadn't been spending all my time in the BEC field, even really a majority of it, for the last few years, and in particular for the last 6 months I've been almost literally unable to read anything that's been published. So I said optimistically, well, at least I will be able to bone up on what's been done in the last, during the actual week of the workshop. What I hadn't realised, of course, is that the last 6 months in the general area of dilute atomic gases have probably been the most exciting 6 months since the original discovery of the stabilisation of the systems. Lots and lots of things have happened, some of them we heard for the first time at this, this workshop. So I'm certainly not going to try to review what's been presented here. I think Gora has already done that very efficiently. Rather, my talk will be a sort of mishmash of some old questions, some of them really old actually, some of them 50 years old or so, to which I think we don't always pay quite enough attention, interspersed with some comments on some of the work of the last few months. If you come from a background of traditional superfluid physics, or superconductivity, helium 4, helium 3, whatever, then basically, if we compare the dilute alkali gases with these systems, there are some disadvantages, but really many more advantages. The disadvantages, as far as I can see, are first of all that we almost inevitably in the alkali gases deal with inhomogeneous, spatially inhomogeneous systems, and of course all theorists ideally would like to have nice homogeneous systems. And secondly, that these gases are very dilute, so various things which are rather easy to measure in, say, a superconductor like direct measurements of currents and so forth don't appear to be feasible, or at least not very easy. On the other hand, of course, as we all know, alkali gases have very many advantages. In some sense, this is the obverse side of my first objection. The geometry can be tailored to almost any shape you want. We can vary parameters in many cases over orders of magnitude. We have the tremendous advantage of optical discrimination of our system. We have multiple species, although I should just comment, of course, that there's a one condensed matter system, in fact, in which we do have this, which is helium-3, which I think is quite a useful analogy for some of the things that go on in the alkali gases. But I think the most important single point about the alkali gases, which I think takes them orders of magnitude beyond what we can do with the traditional superfluids, is the ability to change one's parameters drastically and near instantaneously. That is, over timescales which are very short on the characteristic timescales of the system itself. That is something which just is not feasible, practically not feasible with any known condensed matter system. I think that has opened up a huge new range of experiments in this area. And of course we've heard a lot of applications of these general principles in this conference. People have generated sophisticated spin superpositions. We've had experiments and theory on fast rotation into the quantum Hall effect regime. Lots of fascinating work on restricted geometries, possible applications of quantum information. However, the two things on which I'm going to spend a little time in this talk are two kinds of experiment which I think exploit this instantaneous adjustment in a very dramatic way. One is the Mott insulator to superfluid transition, and the other is the BEC-BCS crossover. So let me start with some very, very old stuff. Hopefully a lot of you will be very familiar and you can go to sleep, which may be nice at the end of your hard week for a bit. The first question I'd like to just remind you about is, how do we actually define BEC in a system of simple bosons? And I have to say that I think by far and away the most satisfactory definition that we've been able to generate is one which was given nearly 50 years ago by Penrose and Arnsager. Namely, we simply take the one-particle density matrix, and we analyse it in terms of its eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. And if it should occur that there is one and only one eigenvalue, which is of the order of n, which we'll call capital N sub 0, and all the rest are of order 1, then we say, well, we normally say we have Bose-Einstein condensation, but I'd rather say we have simple Bose-Einstein condensation, because I believe that we do have to think about the more complicated situations. And then we can define our order parameter in this way, we can define a superfluid velocity, etc., etc. One of the questions, which is relatively rarely raised in this whole game, is why only one macroscopic eigenvalue? Why is simple BEC, by which I mean one and only one macroscopic eigenvalue, why is that the norm? Well, I think, crudely speaking, one can get some insight on this by looking at a simple two-state system, something which people have discussed. In the case of a simple two-state system, let's say a Bose system confined to two wells or perhaps two different internal states, then we can basically treat the difference in the number of particles in the two states and the difference and the relative phase in the two states as conjugate variables. We have a Hamiltonian which, crudely speaking, may look something like this. So this is a term depending on delta n. This is a term depending on the tunneling frequency between our two wells, that which depends on the relative phase in them. And then, of course, as you all know, in the limit where u over t goes to infinity, the system would like, assuming that u is positive, the system would like to minimize the fluctuation in delta n, and therefore we get a Fock state that is an eigenfunction of delta n. In other words, you have a definite number of particles on the one side and on the other side. And that is, by definition, a fragmented state, a fragmented meaning that we have more than one eigenvalue which is macroscopic. In the opposite limit, where u over t goes to zero, then obviously we have a coherent state, which is an eigenfunction of delta phi. We have simple BEC. And you can, a very hand-waving way, I think we can understand in this way why a dilute gas is likely to be essentially a single Bose condensate and not more than one. The kinetic energy is a function of the relative phase at different points in space, and if we take the characteristic distance, that's to be the distance between the particles, then it comes out like that. The potential energy is a function of delta n, the difference in number of particles from point to point in space, that comes out something like that. And so their ratio comes out to be of this order, and so when this quantity is very small, then rather trivially the potential energy is small compared to the kinetic energy, and it's much more important to minimise the kinetic energy, we get a simple eigenfunction of delta phi. That's not a particularly profound remark. I think it's interesting to consider some examples of ground states of simple Bose systems which do not have simple BEC, just to remind ourselves. The first possibility, of course, is that we have no BEC at all, and well, a very trivial example of this, of course, is solid, helium-4. Something closer to the subject matter of this meeting is the Mott insulator phase in optical lattices. And again, people have argued that in this meeting that the rapidly rotating bosons in the quantum Hall regime, again, we might get no Bose condensation at all. The second possibility, we have fragmented BEC, that is, we have more than one eigenvalue which is order n, and say examples are a two-well system in the Fock limit, that's something relatively well known. The case of attractive interactions, and here incidentally, just let me put in as a sort of side remark, I was very interested in the remark that Eric Müller made about the crossover in the two boson molecule problem. And he pointed out that since one's interaction was going to be attractive for part of the crossover region, one was likely to get collapse. The system was likely to be unstable. What I think is possibly interesting about that model is that it seems to me that since the attraction is coming entirely from the mixing in of the closed channel state, and the closed channel state has got a well-defined structure and so forth, it might be possible to actually analyse in this model what actually happens when the collapse takes place, which is, of course, a big unknown in general in the theory of BEC. We know, for example, that if we have something like lithium-7, and we put too many atoms in, it appears to collapse, but I guess we don't really know too much about what happens thereafter, as it were. So it's nice, it would be nice to have a model where we could actually see what are going to be the specific effects of attractive interactions when generated in this kind of way. A third example of a fragmented BEC is the Lorentz-Pupo-Bigelow state of spin and half bosons. That depends, the existence of that state depends rather delicately on the interactions. I actually think that an even nicer example is what I call the KSA state of spin and half bosons. That's the state which was independently discovered by Kuklov and Svistanov and by Sahel Ashab, who's here. It's the state you get when you take a spin and half bose gas, which is subject to an SU2 symmetry, and cool it down from a high temperature state in which it has zero spin polarization. Then it's rather easy to show that simple Bose condensation can't occur, and the ground state for the non-interacting gas is of this form here. It's basically a spin singulate virtual molecules, if you like. And I think that's a very interesting case because, as far as I know, it's the only case known where you can have a system of bosons and even in the absence of interactions, it does not undergo Bose condensation at zero temperature. And it has many, many amusing properties, in fact. One can raise the question, more generally, why are spinless and extended Bose gases so rarely fragmented? Well, of course, there's a rather trivial reason, which we're probably all familiar with. If we just write down, take a dilute system, say, and write down the equilibrium energy in the Hartree-Fock approximation, then we get the usual kinetic energy term, and then we get an interaction term, and the point is that the interaction is essentially a factor of two when the atoms are in different phases, simply because of the Fock term in the potential, but of course when they're in the same state, the Fock term doesn't occur, so that term goes away. And if U0 is repulsive, then of course that will automatically stabilize. They tend to stabilize simple Bose condensation. And presumably that is connected with the fact that almost all calculations have shown that the effect of repulsive interactions is to raise the transition temperature. Now, clearly that can't go on forever, and in fact we know that in real liquid helium-4, the transition temperature is depressed beyond what it is for a non-interacting gas. So I think there is, in some sense, a real question, why in systems with the density of the order of real helium-4 does this argument still essentially appear to work? Why is there no evidence that we ever have fragmentation in real liquid helium-4? I think it's not a totally trivial question. Of course, in practice, we tend to assume simple Bose condensation even in non-equilibrium situations. And a typical example would be where we have, say, we set up a P state of circulating helium, let's say, in an annulus, and we examine the possibility that it will decay to an S state. Now, in principle, it could do that either by going through a Fock state in which I have simply 50% of the particles in a P state and 50% in the S state, or it could do so by going through a coherent state, which is a linear superposition of P and S states. And in fact, almost all the calculations, in particular the original one of Langer and Fischer, always assume that it goes through a coherent state. And the question is there a good reason for that? And I believe, yes, there is, although it's a little more sophisticated than I've written down. The Fock state, which you can write down in this way, can always be written as a linear superposition of coherent states. And so provided that the energy is essentially diagonal in this basis, which in practice for a macroscopic system it usually is, we can come back to that point, then you can see that in some sense, anything we can do with a Fock state, we can do better, or at least as well, with a coherent state. The Fock state simply averages over, the energy of a Fock state simply averages over the energy of a set of coherent states, so it's clear in some sense that the best coherent state will always win. So I think that the traditional neglect of Fock states in that context probably is rather well justified. Now let me come on to a specific topic, which is the Mott-insulated to superfluid transition. We do the usual, consider the usual setup as done in the Minchin experiments, where I start off from a very deep lattice with one atom per site, and I reduce the height of the lattice so that I go over to a very, very shallow lattice. And what we generally believe, and what experiment seems to show, is that you start off with a hot insulating phase, so each atom is tied to a lattice site, you end up with a BEC, and presumably therefore superfluid phase. And in some ways this is rather similar to the melting of solid helium-4 into the superfluid liquid phase, although of course there's an important difference in the sense that there's no external lattice in the case of solid helium-4. Now why is this such a fascinating problem? Well, the reason I find it's a fascinating problem is this. The Mott insulator phase, crudely speaking, is a symmetrized product of wave functions in which each atom sits on one particular lattice site, and you never get double occupation and so forth. So it's crudely speaking of this form here. The wave function in the superfluid state is, of course, in the simplest approximation, just a simple product of particles in the ground state, where the ground state is given something like that. Now, in some sense, it looks as if there ought to be a huge difference between these states. And the reason is the following. In the superfluid state, one can take one particle right across the sample, keeping the other n to the minus one particles fixed, and if you do that, the many-body wave function nowhere vanishes or becomes exponentially small. And this turns out to be absolutely essential to the explanation of superfluidity in the system, I mean, assuming that we believe it occurs. It's certainly a very standard argument in the theory of helium. In the Mott insulator state, that's not true, because basically, in order to take one atom around the ring, I've got to continually occupy one side or the other doubly, and this will give me an exponentially vanishing many-body wave function. So I think the fascinating question which is raised by these experiments is, how long does the system take to find out that it ought to be superfluid, or more precisely, both condensed, and how accurately does it do so? And at first sight, it's rather plausible, or I would have said it a few years ago, it's rather plausible to say the minimum time it would need to find out is the time for a single atom to move across the whole lattice. But then it looks like, from the experiments, that looks like that's not true. It looks as if the time is much more like the time simply to jump to a nearest neighbour site. So that, I think, raises a very interesting question about the precise kinetics with which a wave function of this type converts into what is at first sight a completely different wave function of this type. Let me just mention a couple of problems related to this. Fajr already mentioned that there's a strong connection of this problem to the Higgs-Kibble mechanism in cosmology. I should say that this is the scenario in which the early universe cools through a phase transition, spontaneously breaks a symmetry, but that symmetry is broken in different ways in different parts of the universe, and then they have to connect up together. And as a result, according to Kibble, you get various topological singularities formed, cosmic strings and so forth. In fact, analog simulations of the Higgs-Kibble mechanism have been done among a number of systems, but particularly in superfluid helium-3. But the trouble is they give very ambiguous results. The first question is that in some cases at least the raw data are open to question, and the interpretation of the raw data itself is not, but the interpretation of the raw data is open to question. And in those experiments where it's not open to question, it seems that you only produce vortex lines, the helium analog of cosmic strings, if you already have a normal superfluid counterflow. Now, presumably, the early universe did not have a normal superfluid counterflow, so this is not, from that point of view, an exact analogue of what's going on in the early universe. So I think certainly one can regard this Mott insulator to superfluid transition as, possibly shedding light on the Higgs-Kibble mechanism, but I think it's important to emphasise that the nature of the initial normal state from which you're starting is very different from what it is in the case of helium-3. In the case of helium-3, we have an extended but normal liquid. In the case of the optical lattices, we basically start with what is the analogue of a solid, so forth. But I think it's very interesting to explore both of these. A second experiment, which I'd just like to draw people's attention if they don't know about it, which is somewhat related, at least, and I think maybe rather deeply related to the optical lattice work, is the so-called supersolid behaviour, which is claimed to have been observed in solid helium-4. This is a paper by Moses Chan and Kim in Nature a few weeks ago. The idea here is that you have a dilute concentration of vacancies which act essentially like particles, And these move, these eventually turn into sort of vacancy waves and eventually both condense, and the theory is that they might give you rise to superfluidity. What I find really fascinating about, yes? I'm sorry? Is not well known. I'm sorry? Well, don't. I mean, it's a conjecture. It's a conjecture that they both condense. I mean, to explain the experiment. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, or what I find a very interesting feature, is that this this behavior is actually destroyed by a very small concentration, I think 10 to 100 parts per million, of helium-3. And I believe one can understand that, it's too detailed to go into, but I believe one can understand that if one tries to analyze what is going on in that experiment, not in terms of the vacancies as such, but rather in terms of the motion of the actual atoms and the way in which the many body wave function is connected with itself. And that
what's being destroyed by...
Sorry?
What is being destroyed by the small impurity?
What's being destroyed?
Yeah.
Well... I mean, look, the experimental data is simply that, the experimental data is that in these vical capillaries, where people generally believe, although it's not clear what how firm the basis for it is, that something like a crystalline solid formed, that the system actually fails to rotate with the container at low enough temperatures, like liquid helium, superfluid liquid helium. So, anyway, the point I want to make, and it's a very, very qualitative point, is that I believe that the only way to understand what's going on here is probably in terms of a real many-body calculation in terms of what the actual helium-4 atoms themselves are doing, rather than what the vacancies are doing. And this then gets us back into precisely the same questions about the identity of the atoms and its profound effect on the long-range behavior that we already find in the optical lattice work. And so one question I would like to raise with experimentalists is, and I think Massimo Ambrosio to some extent has answered this, is can one introduce chemical impurities in the optical lattice problem, and would that fundamentally change the kinetics on the Mott insulator to superfluid transition? Now go on quickly to a different question, which is pseudo-BEC or Cooper pairing in a Fermi system. The basic idea here, of course, is as old as Yang in 1962. We take our two-particle density matrix and we can analyze it in terms of its eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. And Yang showed that for an unrestricted number of single particle states, the maximum value of any eigenvalue is n over 2, which is sort of common sense in a way. For Fermi C, of course, it's very boring because all the Ni's are either 1 or 0. If one and only one of the eigenvalues is of order n, then we can talk about simple pseudo-Bose-Einstein condensation or simple Cooper pairing. In BCS theory, of course, this is very, of course, all this comes out very, very, very explicitly. In BCS theory, the eigenvalue here is simply this quantity, the usual anomalous average. It's in equilibrium, it's a function of relative coordinate, and crudely speaking, it has this this form here. So we can actually write down quite explicitly what the Cooper pairs look like, as it were, in the BCS end of the theory. We also find that in BCS theory, the number of Cooper pairs, or the degree of condensation, if you like, defined in this way, is only of the order of Tc over Tf, which is very small in the Bose limit. Just as in the case of the simple Bose system, one can raise the question, why do we almost always seem to get simple pseudo-BEC? That is, why do we never get fragmentation? Why do we never get macroscopic numbers of Cooper pairs occupying, say, two different states? That is not a trivial problem at all. And if you go back in the history, you'll actually find that there's some very interesting controversies associated with that point in the early 60s. When people were discussing the possible states of superfluid helium-3. And in fact, there was a proposal by Gorkov and Galitsky at that time, which is basically equivalent to the hypothesis of fragmentation of your Cooper pairs. And it took quite a bit of work to show that that was not, in fact, the right state. But generally speaking, I think the reason is that if two different states are possible, and you have a non-zero scattering between them, then in the thermodynamic limit, a single coherent state will always be favored. Let me just give you a quick example of how that works. Consider helium-3A. And it turns out that in helium-3A, we believe that the pair states always have the same orbital dependence, so we can factor that out. Then the pairs can either be two upspins or two downspins. Now, the question is, which is correct? This is the state which is usually assumed, which says that the Cooper pairs occupy a linear superposition of up and down states with a given definite relative phase. So that's a standard coherent state in optics language. The alternative is to simply take half your particles and let them pair with spin up, and the other half let them pair with spin down. That's it's a Fock state. So the question is, which of these is right? Well, it turns out that has a rather simple argument in this particular case. The relevant terms in the Hamiltonian are the polarization energy, which depends on S, that's the difference in the number of up and down spins, and that will obviously favor having the same number, having S squared equals zero, so having the same number of up and down spins, so that will favor the Fock state. On the other hand, the dipole interaction turns out to scatter particles between spin up and spin down, so that will favor the coherent state with a definite value of delta phi. In fact, delta phi equals zero. Favor. So you have this competition of these two. So why does the coherent state always win? Well, actually the answer is rather straightforward. In the thermodynamic limit, it turns out that chi is of order n and gd is also of order n. So this term goes down dramatically as you increase the volume, this one goes up in importance, and therefore the coherent state is always favored. But the dipole energy is really quite small. So that raises the interesting question, for small enough samples, would this situation actually be reversed? Would the correct state of helium-3A actually be the Fock state? And I believe, in fact, in these little inclusions which you can get of liquid helium-3 and solid helium-4, that could be the case. And this then would force us to totally revise the theory of nuclear magnetic resonance, which is rather well developed, for the coherent state, to make it applicable to these situations. And I've recently written a little paper on that. Finally, some comments on the BEC-BCS crossover problem. The first question, I think, that we... I say these are just, in some sense, random remarks. I'm not going to try to survey everything that's been done or all the theory that's been developed at all. The first question we can raise is, what is the optimal measure of the degree of condensation, F, which we are interested in when we discuss the BEC-BCS crossover problem? Well, if you're firmly in the BEC limit, then basically all reasonable measures give precisely the same value, so we needn't worry too much about that. It's in the BCS limit that we're worried about, and so what I've listed here in this column is the value which you would get by using these various definitions for the normal state, let's say just above TC, and for the superconducting state at zero temperature. Remember, this is both in the BCS limit. Well, I've already given you one definition, which is Yang's original one, which is the maximum eigenvalue of rho 2 divided by n to make it dimensionless. That has the advantage that it's zero in the normal state, but in the superfluid state, in the BCS limit, it's still very small compared to 1. And somehow one might feel in one's bones that that's really not an adequate measure of the degree of condensation. Now, the reason it's not an adequate measure, basically, is that this is a measure of a static property, that is, an equilibrium property of the system. In some sense, what is peculiar about a superfluid is not its equilibrium state, but its response to external probes. And so then it turns out that mostly the response of a superfluid to external probes is not a function of the whole filled Fermi C, but only of states near the Fermi surface. So one can now try to define some response function which will be zero in the normal state, but which will be essentially one in the superfluid state at zero temperature. And there are various possibilities, the most obvious being the straight superfluid density, which has exactly that property. But I would remind you that there are other properties of a standard BCS superconductor, for example, which play the same role. For example, if one looks at the spin susceptibility as a function of the normal state value, again, it's zero. In that case, you have to subtract a one. But basically, what you define in that way is, again, zero in the normal state, one in the superfluid state at zero temperature. And in fact, there's a whole cluster of definitions one could use. All of these would give this, but they'd have different behaviors at intermediate temperatures. Well, somehow one feels in a way even that's not quite adequate, and in particular when one thinks about the sweep, the magnetic field sweep experiments, it's tempting to think about a quantity which you might call the degree of pairing and is defined by this quantity divided by capital N. And this certainly has the advantage that it's one in the superfluid state at zero temperature, but the trouble is that even in the normal state, most of your particles are way down there in the Fermi C, so they are paired up, K to minus K. So in the normal state, it only gives a value of one minus a small correction there. So it's somehow it doesn't seem to be quite an adequate definition of what we really mean by the degree of condensation. And I think it's very important to determine which of the various of these various quantities one's actually measuring when one does experiments of different kinds in the crossover region, because otherwise we're going to be arguing at cross purposes because we mean different things by the condensate number. Yep. Yes. Thanks. Good. Okay. Well, more specifically, the experiments to date raise, first of all, questions about the equilibrium state. The most obvious, two most obvious questions, I think, are, first of all, is a single channel model adequate for the real life experiments in which you're sweeping through a Fischbach resonance? Is it adequate in the strong resonance limit and or in the weak resonance limit? I won't attempt to say anything about that because I realise that there are all sorts of opinions held by various speakers at this this conference, which is clearly something which we have to settle as soon as possible. The second most obvious question is, let's just assume for the sake of argument that at least in the strong resonance case the answer is yes here, then is the naive Eagles ansatz, which is just basically the BCS ansatz appropriately slightly generalised, is this first of all quantitatively correct over the whole of the crossover region? And I think one probably does know by now that the answer to that is no. One first of all has the so-called Gorkov-Melnikov-Kudorov correction at the extreme BCS limit. That is not something which is handled by the naive wave function. You have to do it, as it would, go out and do it separately. And then, even more convincingly, of course, Petrov, Shlebnikov, and Solomon have shown that in the near but not quite totally Bose-condensed limit, again, you have corrections which do not come out of this naive ansatz. So I think, quantitatively, one has to say almost certainly the answer is no. But then one, I think one can raise the question, is the naive ansatz at least qualitatively correct? That is, can we use it as a starting place by, point, do perturbation theory on it? Does it have the right topology? And I would say that, at least as far as I've been able to understand them, all the experimental evidence, at least to date, is the answer to that question is yes. That is, there's no obvious evidence that you get some kind of phase transition occurring as you go from one end to the other, whatever. I think a very important general question in this area is the following. Doing the actual detailed many-body theory in the crossover region, as we've seen, is actually pretty hard, and it's highly non-trivial. Is it possible, perhaps, to place rigorous bounds on the transition temperature in that area from rather general arguments? Well, I don't know of any such arguments. But if not, can we at least say, given a particular temperature, we can at least put a bound on the condensate fraction at that temperature? And I believe the answer there is maybe. And the reason I believe it's maybe is that I do know that, first of all, I know two things. I know that Hohenberg's lemma will always give us a bound on the condensate density. It may not be a very impressive one, but it will be a bound at least. But more importantly, I know that in the extreme Bose limit, the limit of tightly bound Bose molecules, structureless particles, there is in fact a limit which you can put on the condensate fraction as a function of temperature, which is quite rigorous and which reduces to the standard standard textbook result in the limit of zero interaction. And so I think it's very, for me, a very important question is it possible to generalise that kind of argument so as to get a general upper limit on the condensate fraction as a function of temperature? I throw that out as a challenge to the theorists. This is my final view graph. So far, we have some questions regarding the equilibrium experiments. I think in many ways it's even more fascinating to think about these magnetic field sweep experiments and to think about the various timescales involved. One obvious timescale is the inverse gap frequency, which is because a strong function of where you are on the transition, or that is what value of k of a you're at. A second timescale is the time you need to change the condensate number at a constant value of k of a. A third one is the time for internal equilibrium of the quasi-particle gas, and I don't believe that these two are necessarily equal. I think we have to think rather hard about that, because in some sense the conversion of a pair into the condensate is an inelastic process, whereas the internal equilibration of the quasi-particle gas is an elastic process. So I think we shouldn't automatically assume that these two are the same. And finally, there's time for thermal equilibrium with the bath, but it seems to me probably in this kind of problem that's not terribly relevant, simply because it's very difficult to think what the bath actually is in most of these experiments. You have got a really rather well-isolated system. If the sweep is fast compared to both the pair collision time and the quasi-particle equilibration time, but slow compared to h bar of a delta, then I think at first sight my instinct would be that in these magnetic sweep experiments you actually conserve something like the degree of pairing, which, as you've seen, was not something which is usually defined to be related to the condensate number in the BCS limit. If the sweep is slow compared to all of these, but fast compared to the external equilibration time, then I would think you should probably conserve the entropy, and of course we have heard arguments which about the details of the crossover which depend on that. But I think this whole field right now is really quite wide open and needs a lot of further thought. Finally, I just comment on the NMR behavior. I think in some ways the NMR experiments to me are the most fascinating of all. And they're firstly for the following reason, that there's a very general theorem that to the extent that your Hamiltonian as a function of the nuclear spin is just an isotropic term minus an external field term, then there's a quite rigorous theorem that your resonance can only occur at the normal frequency. And that's independent of whether you're breaking up molecules to form single atoms or not. So I think any deviation from that has to tell you that there are extra terms in your Hamiltonian which do not have this property. And that, I think, is a terribly important piece of information. And I suspect that one's going to get a lot out of looking at the behavior of the NMR. I'll just remind you that it was precisely this property, basically, which played a key role in trying to decipher what was going on in superfluid helium 3, in fact, when it was first found. So I have a strong hunch, though clearly I have vested interest, that this is also going to be the case in the alkali gases. And finally, just make me mention two miscellaneous points. I do think it would be very interesting to do a controlled quench of the system, that is, a controlled change of the value of KFA, stopping entirely within the BCS regime and looking for the time dependence of the way in which the order parameter is formed. There have been a number of recent calculations on that, and it's an experiment I believe one can now actually do. And the second is that if indeed, as some people have suggested, one can actually generate a P-wave alkali gas superfluid, that would be incredibly interesting, because you remember that as you go from the BEC to the BCS end, there's only one point at which anything in some sense qualitatively different happens, and that's when the chemical potential goes through zero. But if you've got an S-wave superconductor, then all that happens is that the slope of delta as a function of the parameters changes a bit in that regime. If you've got a P-wave superfluid, by contrast, and assuming it's sort of ABM type, that only parallel spins are formed, then what you find is that above the transition on the BCS side, you have your minimum excitation energy is zero, and then below it, or minimum fermion excitation energy is zero, below it, it's a finite value. So I think that's much, in some sense, it should be much more dramatic in that case. Well, now, so let me conclude now. Alan Griffin reminded me that earlier on in this workshop that when we got together at the end of a similar workshop 5 or 6 years ago, I seemed to be very pessimistic about the future of the whole field. I actually have a Freudian lapse of memory about this whole episode, but I have to trust Alan to remember it correctly. And I suspect if I was, it was basically because of a feeling that somehow in this field, at least in those days, nature seemed to be doing exactly what the textbooks tell her to. And that was, in some sense, rather boring. Well, I think in some sense one has to say that particular aspect hasn't changed. I mean, mostly, with a few exceptions, mostly nature is still doing what the textbooks tell her to. The only difference is that we're going to have to rewrite the textbooks at a speed which is exponentially approaching the speed of light. Because, and the reason for that, of course, is that one has these incredible new possibilities, particularly, I would say, associated with this possibility of changing the parameters instantaneously, which were simply not there with the traditional superfluidism, which therefore people never considered. And now one's got a whole new range of problems for which there is no theory, or was not until a few months ago. And so I do think that this is has made the subject extremely exciting. And I certainly look forward very much to the next conference of this type. But before I conclude, let me just express our thanks to the KITP for hosting this conference, and to Jason, Jura, Eric, Sandy, and Chris for all the hard work that they've done in organising it. I think we've all enjoyed it very much, and I, for one, am certainly looking forward very much to the next one of this time. Thank you.
Jason wanted to say a few words. I think
probably there would be questions for Tony, and then I think maybe I should say a few words after the questions.
Okay, so we'll take a few questions. Sure.
You were telling us about the experiment on super solids in solid helium, I guess.
Yes.
So vacancies form a stationary density wave. Yes, in this experiment.
The usual belief. Well, so the only theory, which is as far as I know, which has so far shown any capability of explaining this the phenomenon that Moses sees, is that the vacancies are Bose condensed, so they form a sort of vacancy wave. But it's a quantum mechanical k equals zero wave in the usual sense.
Because actually, if I think about the term super solid, which was actually introduced by you, I'm usually thinking that there is a sort of a density wave on the background of a homogeneous order parameter or the homogeneous density profile.
Well, actually, technically, there are two different types of super solid. The what I call the Andreev Lifshitz-Chester version is that you actually have less atoms than you do lattice sites for some unknown thermodynamic reason. Okay, and then then basically the ground. If I just take a single vacancy, then the ground state is a coherent superposition of that vacancy being on all the possible sites. A second possible kind of supersolid, which is the one I think I was implicitly thinking of when I wrote my paper in 1970, was that despite the fact that you had an equal number of atoms to sites, you could nevertheless get, in some sense, a mobile system. So in fact, that's pretty much like what you get in the not insulated to superfluid, the optical lattice case, if you make the optical lattice sufficiently weak. You've still got a finite periodicity, but everything is clearly mobile. And certainly, in fact, superfluid.
There is more question. In the slide where you have listed all the time scales,
yes,
there's no time scale for the trap. That it some
for the trap.
For the trap.
Oh, okay.
Because you don't think it's, the inhomogeneity of these systems plays a role, or?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. The reason I didn't put that in was that I was implicitly thinking of a theoretical model in which things were homogeneous, but of course, you're absolutely right.
Tony, could we go back to your last slide, but one?
Yeah, the one on, let me think, sorry, that was the one on this one, is that one?
So I have a question. There's every condensed matter theorist I've ever talked to has always told me that if I go about halfway down, we talk about this, I have pairing, a complete pairing. In the normal state, we have complete pairing because of the sum on k of nk up and n minus k down. every condensed matter theorist always tells me this is true. I've never met an atomic physicist who understands it. Why should there be pairing between these particles of equal and opposite momentum? These are somehow separate from Cooper pairs, if I understand. Why is there something special about K and minus K? Doesn't this violate Galilean invariance or something?
No, because you have the frame. Is a picked out frame, which is the one in which the center of mass of the system is at rest, and I'm implicitly using that frame. Now, of course, I could consider I could stay in my lab frame and imagine a case where my whole Fermi C is moving, and then, of course, this would no longer be quite true. I'd then have to pair K up with K plus Q down.
But I mean, if I have a normal state of bosons, it's not the case that most of those bosons have zero momentum, even though, in fact, the composite. So I'm going deep into the BEC limit here. My electron and my rubidium ion are stuck strongly together, and I find in the normal state that most of those pairs do not have zero momentum, except when I'm in the superfluid state.
Well, okay, let's consider the hypothetical case. Well, it's no longer hypothetical, I guess, but let's consider the case where I have two Fermi atoms, which I'll regard for the present purposes as point particles, and they have indeed formed, they've got together to form molecules, and the molecules are then both condensed. If the Bose condensation is into the zero momentum center of mass state, then clearly the individual atoms always have K and minus K.
Yes.
So you
yes.
do have complete pairing.
So, but that's a superfluid state.
That is, presumably it's a BEC at zero temperature, yes. Yep.
So this is somehow a zero temperature thing.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble with Fermi systems is that really about 99% of the system is completely inert, because it's down there in the Fermi sea where nothing is going on, as it were. And you don't, in some sense, you want a definition. It seems to me, in defining a degree of condensation, you don't want to have to deal with that, really. And that's why I think, in some sense, this second the superfluid response is a better definition.
One should say, though, that Tony was sort of a minority movement in that matter, because he did not
believe in
order to dominate. So, in a very dramatic way,
Wait.
That's a rainbow. So, it's very interesting. Later on, you mentioned an energy gap.
Yes.
And you never mentioned anywhere. What's that energy gap? Usually, going back to Gorkov, the energy gap, you know, is this anomalous paired function.
Yeah. Oh, it's basically related to this this eigenfunction. We should go to the Fermi case for that. But what I disagree, I think what Alan and I disagree about is not whether it's useful to define an order parameter. I certainly agree that it is. Rather, it's the question of how you define it. And my definition, you see, is I think rather simple and straightforward in terms of the maximum of the single macroscopic eigenvalue and the associated eigenfunction there. In the Fermi case, you can basically, what you want to do is to associate your order parameter with some aspect of this two particle eigenvalue associated with the macroscopic, the eigenfunction associated with the macroscopic eigenvalue. So, for example, you can take the value of F as usually defined at zero separation. That's a perfectly well defined function. But again, I emphasize, you don't need all this stuff here. You don't need to define anomalous averages. You can just do it as Yang did in terms of the actual eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. This is just, in some sense, a mathematical convenience to enable you to do a few tricks more cleverly.
Very elegant, but I think most of the entire people would say nothing useful has ever come out of the
Yang work. I'll tell you one thing which I find very useful, which comes out of the Yang work, although you could say, and perhaps in retrospect is obvious. I said that Yang showed that the maximum value of any Ni is N over 2, and that's true as long as you have a completely unrestricted number of single particle states. The moment you restrict the number of particle states, of single particle states, for example, if you're in a band, a finite width band, then that goes down dramatically. That, I think, is a useful piece of information. It's not, I mean, it may seem obvious in retrospect, but I don't think I could have proved it without Yang.
I was wondering if you could comment on connections between this discussion of fragmentation that you gave,
yes,
and the quasi-condensates that are discussed in lower dimensional systems have been observed.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very, very interesting question, because certainly I think the case of these lower dimensional systems are a clear counterexample to the statement which is you still frequently find made in textbooks, that Bose condensation is both a necessary and a sufficient condition for superfluidity in the Bose system. And it's clear that's not true. And if you look at the arguments which are, as a very nice argument, I think, by Conan Sherrington way back in a paper, a very nice paper in the mid-60s, if you look at that hard, I think what they claim to prove this result, that Bose condensation is necessary and sufficient for superfluidity. If you look at it hard, I think they're making some implicit assumptions about how the sums over k, for finite but small k, diverge or fail to. I think that's probably where it goes wrong.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this maximum eigenvalue.
Yeah.
I think it's... You can obtain it probably trivially if you have a system of dilute pairs of very small size.
Sure.
But the question is, can you have a big eigenvalue when that's not the case? You see, is that related with the size of the pair? You see, I mean, as a, as a general result, do you know anything about that?
Well, not really. I mean, clearly, you're absolutely right. At the moment you've decided that your particles are paired up to form essentially diatomic molecules, then fairly clearly the definition of n zero, which I've given, just reduces to the value to the definition I gave for the Bose system. So clearly it can't be greater than n over two. You would expect, certainly qualitatively, that as you go from the BC to the BCS limit, this eigenvalue goes down. And we certainly know that it is a lot smaller at the BCS end. I mean, it's an order. How fast it goes down. Okay, well, no, one doesn't know that. I mean, if you just use the Eagles ansatz for the wave function, you can certainly calculate it. I haven't, but it shouldn't be a big task to do that. And then, of course, but I think a more interesting question in a way is, are we actually ever measuring precisely that quantity? And if so, how?
Is that a quick one? Or?
If you look at the eigenfunction to do with the condensate and the boson case, let's say, not the fermionic case, and you imagine doing a mean field calculation and doing Gross-Podolsky, how different can those functions be?
I'm sorry, how different can what be from what?
The eigenfunction of your single particle density matrix and the answer you get from a mean field calculation.
Well, I think...
Can they be orthogonal, or do they always have to have some overlap?
Well, you have to tell me, I think, how you determine the mean field function, because I would think that the... here, my definition, you see, of the order parameter is precisely related by definition to the maximum the eigenfunction associated with maximum eigenvalue. If you want me to make a distinction, you have to give me a different definition.
Well, I'm meaning one, if you just take the many body wave function and calculate your single particle density matrix and diagonalize it,
yes.
And you take then the Hamiltonian which that came from and do a mean field calculation, and do Gross-Podolsky, I don't think there's any guarantee those two functions will be the same function.
I'm sorry, I'm still slightly confused because. Okay, I have one definition of my order parameter which is directly related to the single, the macroscopic eigenfunction, if you like. What's the alternative? That's what I'm clear
about. Well, it's not a definition, it's just saying if you do the proper calculation of the full many-party wave function, use that definition, you get one eigenfunction out. Now, if you do a mean field calculation on the same Hamiltonian, which is not a precise calculation, a mean field one, then, and look at the solution of Gross-Podolsky, how different can that function be to the real one? I mean, could it be orthogonal, or does it tend to be some relationship or whatever?
Well, no, I think that would depend on what you're basically asking, I think, is how accurate is standard TGGP?
Yeah, or are there examples where in fact it's orthogonal?
It's clear that here's a case in which it's totally obvious, trivially, that the time-dependent Ginzburg-Pitayevsky cannot be right. By time-dependent Ginzburg-Pitayevsky, I mean an equation which conserves the number of particles in the condensate. So I just do a simple cryogenic experiment, say, where I let the system equilibrate with the walls and so forth. It's clear that the condensate number has to change during that process, and it's clear that TDGP does not allow for that. So in that kind of situation, I think you're very badly wrong.
Yeah, I was really thinking about that equilibrium case.
Solid helium 4, for example. I don't know if I'll answer your question.
A very short comment still regarding this, or two. So as the experiments are so good and they have shown that they can always improve,
yes.
I would like to add maybe a part of the Santa Barbara consensus, that if we had to devise an ideal experiment for these Fermi gases, this should be an experiment that is made of three different sets of measurements. One that measures the rho 2 at larger as a function of distance in a slit experiment, and this would give the condensate fraction in some sense. Yeah. Then an experiment is able to measure the single particle excitations, so a pump and probe experiment with a single particle that is able to take single particles out of the Fermi sea. And then a superfluid-like experiment, so a transverse probe.
Yes.
And these three sets of measurements give completely different information that are not cannot be merged one into the other. And all the three of them are needed to have an ideal understanding of the system.
Yes, indeed, I totally agree with you. I think I should be able to use this. I would just point out one thing, though, that in the simple Bose case, people often, experimentalists often say that they have measured the condensate fraction directly. But in fact, that measurement does require a sort of non-trivial amount of theory. What they've actually done is to measure something like a density profile, and then they've interpreted it in terms of the theory of a weakly interacting gas and so forth. So now I think there probably are experiments which you could say in some sense measure the condensate number directly. For example, certain kinds of interference type experiment might do that. But you do have to think rather carefully when you say you're measuring N0.
Well, this seems like a good moment to say thank you to you all. And thank you to Tony for a nice talk. And but you're not quite off the hook yet. Jason has.
Usually at the end of the conference, it's a time to thank various speakers and give acknowledgments. In this conference, we have been trying to do things slightly differently, and then we try to have more discussions, and I don't know whether we have succeeded, so we also try to do something slightly differently here. And the reason that we do it slightly differently is because we are very inexperienced. At least this is the first workshop, this conference of this magnitude and this size, this length we organize. And so much so that we have forgotten. Well, after yesterday's Alan's after dinner talk, we forget to say something to the audience. So therefore, we're going to, if you allow me, we would have our after dinner talk now. And the after dinner talk has nothing to do with physics and would be about stories, news, gossips. And then at the end, we will give some acknowledgments and thanks. Now, so I will come to the part one of my talk, which is stories and news. And the central message is the congratulations and well wishing. Now, the first story I'd like to tell you is that in last November, when I went to MIT, and then the Kathy say, Jason, what do you think? I say, what? What do you think about Tony? I say, what happened to Tony? Anything wrong? I say, no, he got the Nobel Prize. So it turns out I was traveling. I didn't know that on that day he got the Nobel Prize. So Tony, I would like the audience to know that Tony is actually the first one who organized the first BEC conference at Santa Barbara. So we are just following that tradition. So thank you very much, Tony, and for organizing the first one. So this is a story about the big L, which is not story number one. Now the story number one is story number two is about big G, and then I would like to congratulate Alan, who has been recently elected to the Canadian Royal Society, and he has been a great supporter, contributor, entertainer, for our community, for this community, and then he has been in the business well before BEC was discovered. So I think the community owe a lot to Alan, and Alan has just, I think, retired, so there's no reason that he would not be able to write more papers. Now, the third person I would like to congratulate very much is Professor George Shnapnikov, and he has just got a new professorship at the OSE. He's now a professor at France and Amsterdam. So I interpret that means that whenever you go to Europe, we have free room and board. Now, just to make parallel to everybody, and then I have no choice but to give him the title of. Now let me give continue the people update, and this is a set of young people who has recently moved various places in the field, and Jacopo has left, and Carrizotto, he will be a professor, assistant professor at Trento, and Han Pu, I think he will be joining us later in the workshop. He is a new professor, these are all theories, by the way, at Rice University, and Vincent Liu just got a job at the University of Pittsburgh, and he will start soon. And Eric Miller has started last fall at Cornell as assistant professor. And then I think Dima will be at Harvard at ITAM for a few years. Fei Chao has just moved to UBC. And these people have lots of good ideas, very productive. The two arrows means these two people are particularly productive because they have recently have babies, I think. Now I like to thanks to the other workshop. The IDP has kindly to put two workshops together so that we could have interactions. And the other workshop have sent us two powerful people to give us the additional insights in various issues related to strongly correlated systems. So we like to thank this representative for the other workshops. And I would also like to thank Professor Vinay Ambegaugar from Cornell, and he has been, I think, in the last couple of years going to some of these workshops. And then I think his job is to keep us honest and make sure that we didn't say anything wrong, as he has just did. And so here's a finished first part of my talk, and second part of my talk is to say thanks. And the first of course is to thank the KITP staff, and then Sue and her staff, and co-workers has done a wonderful job. And And I would like to thank my co-organizers, and Eric and Jora has been a wonderful co-organizers, and then exceedingly, I think we work quite effortlessly. And there are two people I would like to thank specially, which is Sandy and Chris, and I would like to thank them so much so that I would write it down. I say that kindness, calmness, wisdom is a constant source of inspiration and reminder of popular behavior. And then finally, I would like to say thank you to speakers and participants. Now, I don't mean it lightly. So I really mean, we really thank participants because we see so much energies and so much ideas and so much interaction. Thank you very much for coming. I wish you, we all wish you a very nice journey home, and thank you very much for coming.
We should all say thanks to Jason for organizing this conference. Yes?